Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe. I'm Thomas Hill. My guest today is the artist, printer, and papermaker Radha Pandey. She has an MFA in Book Arts from the University of Iowa's Center for the Book. Her artist books are distributed in collections all over the world, including special collections here at Vassar College, where last Monday she gave a talk on traditional Indian papermaking along with a demonstration. Radha is originally from Delhi, and she's living in Cleveland now. Hello, Radha.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you on the show. You know, I wanted to talk about traditional artisanal papermaking, but first I wanted to ask you about your career as an artist as well as a researcher. So the question I suppose to start is, how did you become interested in the book arts and then in the history of papermaking?
Well, I became interested in book arts through papermaking, actually. So when I was very young, my mother took a visit to Japan, and when she came back, she brought these small pieces of origami paper with her. And that was the first time that I'd seen anything like it. You know, I'd only seen copy paper at that young age. And this paper was so different. You know, it was translucent and the texture was completely different. And the opacity was different. It reflected light differently. And it was in all these colors. And I just couldn't get over it. And I think that memory has stayed with me for a very long time. And so when it came for me to go to undergrad, I chose, you know, what I could that was closest to a visual art, and that was visual communication design at the time. And I was lucky enough then during my undergraduate studies to receive a fellowship to go to Haystack Mountain School of Craft in Maine and pick any class that I wanted, which was an amazing opportunity. And it was also the first time that I was traveling abroad by myself. So it was terrifying at the same time. But as luck would have it, they were offering Japanese papermaking for 3 weeks with Catherine Nash. And so there was no, you know, there was no thinking about it. That's the one I picked. And that kind of opened up my world to this new field of book arts, which I didn't even know existed, because there were people from the field of bookbinding and papermaking and printmaking and other kinds of visual arts that were taking that class. And I got to meet with them and kind of just realize that this world actually exists. And it really expanded my view of what working with your hands can actually mean.
So you became a book artist, essentially someone who makes artist books?
Right. Well, that was pretty slow in coming. At that time, I was still very interested in paper as a material. And I met with people that made it possible for me to think about a career as not a graphic designer, but maybe even a paper maker. And so I kind of started looking into that more seriously. And after I graduated, I decided to take another trip to the U.S. and just travel around and visit with people of a similar mindset and see how they're doing, how they make their living, how are they surviving in today's world doing what they love doing versus what they have to do. And that's when I met Timothy Barrett, who teaches at the Center for the Book at the University of Iowa, at a conference, a hand papermakers conference in Tennessee. And he kind of encouraged me to apply for the degree, and I did. And that's kind of what set the ball rolling. And from papermaking, I went to printing and then eventually into artist books.
Can you describe what an artist book is before you talk about your own artist books a bit?
Well, I suppose an artist book can be a book that's made by an artist, or an artist book can be a book that employs techniques that you do by hand. So for me, it is a book that I would make myself, for which I sometimes make the paper, set the type, print, sometimes write the text for, and definitely do the illustrations for and print them by hand as well.
They differ from ordinary books in many ways. It's hard. I know they're a hard thing to define. I had a friend, Rosemary Furtak, who once defined them as a book that refuses to behave like a book. You know, they're like books, but they sort of misbehave in one way or another. You know, so They're not conventional books just meant to be put on a library shelf and picked off and read. And your books are like that a bit also, aren't they?
Yeah, some of them are definitely like that. And most of them definitely do ask the viewer to engage in a more physical or tactile way than you would with a normal book. And a lot of the work I create focuses on my perception of the natural environment and its fragility in relation to our existence and our experience. And that's kind of what I try to evoke when a viewer reads that book.
One of your works we're just about to put in an exhibit here in the art library. It's the one that has to do with classification and classification by shape.
Right. That book is called Taxonomy of Shape, and I made it during my time as a resident at Women's Studio Workshop, and it came out of the research that I did for my thesis work, for my MFA, and part of that research kind of involved looking into the history of taxonomy or the history of classification, and what I read kind of shocked me, which was that, you know, we try to classify everything in our natural environment into these very strict categories so we know exactly where they fit. But we don't take into account the fact that evolution is at play and that things are always changing. They're changing slowly, but they are in fact changing. And so you can't actually fit these things into these categories because they will eventually change and want to move out. So what do you do then? It's a very difficult task. And so that book kind of plays on that idea, that ridiculous idea that we have to fit everything into its own little box. And what it does is takes three basic geometric shapes, a circle, square, and triangle, and then tries to fit everything or a selection of everything from our natural and man-made environment into just those three shapes. So you get very odd things in the same category, like an onion, an eyeball, the sun, the moon sometimes, in the category of a circle. And they have nothing else in common except that they're a circular shape.
And then you had another book where you essentially describe everything you own. You inventoried everything that you had in your apartment.
Right. So this is another book called Taking Stock that I did about a year after I reached Iowa, because I arrived in Iowa with two suitcases in hand and nothing else. And after a year, I had accumulated so much stuff that it was just, you know, it was shocking to me. And so it was a cathartic process to kind of inventory everything in my life at the time and categorize it by material, you know, the material that it was made from, and then make a book out of that.
You mentioned the Women's Studio Workshop, and we have this wonderful facility across the river called the Women's Studio Workshop, and I wonder if you could say a few words about it?
Yeah, well, I was fortunate enough to do an artist in residency there in the winter of 2015, and what I did was art and education book residency, where you have to go in and you get 10 weeks of time and funding and a space to live, and what you have to do is teach a class as well as produce an artist book. And I think that it's just a wonderful environment for artists to go and have space and time to think and make their work, and young people to come and learn from them. Which was part of the exchange that I did as well. And then over the summer, I have summer workshops, and they call it Summer Art Institute, where they have instructors from all over the country come and teach classes in, about papermaking, printmaking, bookbinding, and everything in between.
And I should say, we have in our collection here their archive. We archive all the artist books by women that they keep themselves, and then eventually they send them on to us here at Vassar. So it makes it really for us a wonderful collection of artist books that we have access to, including your own is in there. So
They have maybe 9 or 10 repositories across the U.S. Of all the books, because they have 3 to 5 maybe artists that come in per year specifically for making an edition of artist books. And so they have a massive collection. It's quite an amazing place.
You mentioned that you became interested in paper to begin with because of your exposure to Japanese papermaking processes, but then you become interested in traditional Indian or Islamic papermaking. And how did that happen?
Well, yes, I became interested in papermaking because of Japanese papermaking, and that is also one of Tim Barrett's specialties. And so when I came to the Center for the Book, I expected to learn about many kinds of papermaking, but particularly Japanese-style papermaking. And I did, but a part of that class was also an introduction to what is called Islamic-style papermaking or Islamic world papermaking. Mm-hmm. That is technically the kind of paper that is made traditionally in India.
Mm-hmm.
And so he showed us a film about papermaking in India that he had made, and we had to do a reading called Gift of the Conquerors by Alexandra Sotiriou. Wow. About traditional papermakers in India. And so being obsessed with paper all my life, I was kind of shocked that I had no idea that this was going on right under my nose, and had been in India for 25 years and not even heard of this even once. And so that kind of got me more interested in studying traditional techniques in my own country. And every time I would go back home, I would try to look for these papermakers and try to learn more about them firsthand.
And this kind of papermaking by hand, it differs, of course, from modern industrial, especially Western processes of making paper, doesn't it? I mean, it's traditional materials and traditional tools, and it's made on a small scale.
Yeah, I would say any kind of traditional papermaking does differ from modern industrialized versions of the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's because we're just manufacturing on a completely different scale now and for a completely different kind of market now.
Yeah.
And there's more of a demand for that, and it's a lot cheaper. But traditional techniques were definitely more, I would say, in touch with their environment.
Well, that's what struck me about the process when you were showing the images about how artisanal paper is made in India. The river is the source of the water. Local plants are the source of, the hemp that's made into the mash that's turned into the paper. And even the dyes seem to be local materials. And it seems very environmentally friendly, the whole process.
Right. And I think that was because of the time that this kind of papermaking existed, allowed for that kind of thing.
Yeah. Modern industrial methods have to be about the most destructive industries there are as far as the environment goes, in terms of waterways and also in terms of the forests that are cut down. Some paper industries are better than others, I know.
Right, definitely. The destruction of the forests is mainly for paper that we use and throw away.
So this is often called Islamic papermaking. It's a technical term for it, but is it particularly Islamic, or is it just papermaking on the Indian subcontinent?
I'm glad you asked that, because it's easy to misconstrue the term Islamic papermaking as something having to do with the religion of Islam,
mm-hmm.
when actually I believe it has more to do with the geographical spread of Islamic empire at the time and its influence in culture.
Mm-hmm.
So just as Western papermaking techniques weren't related to Christianity and weren't dubbed Christian papermaking, in the same way, in my opinion, it would be incorrect to call this Islamic papermaking. But again, until we can all come up with a term that we're all happy with and that takes into account the geographic origin versus the religious connection, we should stick to Islamic papermaking for now, or Islamic world papermaking.
Is the paper used for Hindu texts also?
Yes, it is. And I guess that's the other issue, is that, it's the style of papermaking that's used in a wide geographical area.
Sure.
And those geographical areas have a presence of Islamic culture, and that's the reason why we're using this term.
Can you talk then about how hand paper is made in India? I mean, what the process is like?
Yeah, so traditionally, paper is made on a wooden supported frame with a flexible screen or mat on top, kind of similar to a placemat. Although this placemat would be made using hollow stems of grass that are woven together. And then they would have a dowel on the top and the bottom of that screen, or that mat. And then on either side, you would have removable sticks called deckel sticks.
Mm-hmm.
And then this entire assembly, so the supported frame, the screen, and the two deckel sticks, are held together and lowered into a vat of pulp, which would traditionally be fermented hemp, rag, and or raw hemp mixed with water. And then this entire thing would be lowered into the water and lifted up and placed on the surface of the water and moved slowly back and forth so that the fiber distributes itself evenly. And what happens is that the screen acts like a sieve, and so all the water drains through and the pulp is left behind in the form of a very thin, wet sheet.
Mm-hmm.
And then this entire thing is dipped again a second time into the vat, and any uneven spaces in that freshly formed sheet are filled out. And then once that second sheet drains, it's made a slightly thicker sheet that's on the screen. Then the entire assembly is very gently pushed back into the surface of the water, and the water pushes up that sheet off of the screen. And as soon as that happens, the paper maker lifts the entire thing out of the water and lets it drain. And then the screen is picked up and laid down upside down, so the paper is now facing, you know, a piece of wet felt. So it's laid on a piece of wet felt, and that's called couching. And then the excess water is gently squeezed out, and then the screen is kind of lifted away, and a sheet of paper is left behind on that wet felt, and it's the water tension that helps it come off the screen. And then you'd lay another piece of felt or interfacing on top, and then just keep repeating the process.
And there's a sort of miraculous chemical reaction here that allows the paper to be made, isn't there? I mean, it's the reason we have paper, that causes the paper to be formed, essentially one substance formed out of this mash.
Right. It's just all the hydrogen molecules bonding together and forming the sheet. So as the water leaves the pulp, those hydrogen molecules become stronger and stronger. So once you finish that stack of paper, you would squeeze the excess water out of it using, you know, just your own body weight or a hydraulic press. And that release of water then strengthens those bonds even more, and then you can actually lift those sheets up off the felts and hang them up to dry.
And they're not necessarily hung on lines, are they? You had images of women pasting them onto a wall where they're dried?
Right. So traditionally in India, they would be brushed onto a treated wall. And they would dry on the wall and then peel right off when they were dry.
And then sometimes they're processed after this. They're sized and smoothed down.
Yes. So that process is specific to the style of paper making. I haven't seen it with any kind of Western handmade papers. So after the paper is dry, it's brushed externally with a camel chest bone, and that picks up any kind of extraneous fibers that might be sticking up out of the surface of the sheet. And after that's done, they are sized with wheat starch size and then dried. And then after the size dries, they are burnished with an agate stone on both sides, and that prepares the paper for calligraphy. It makes, you know, it makes them kind of get a high shine, and that helps the ink sit right on top of the paper.
Some of the papers are almost translucent, aren't they? And they're very leathery looking.
Yes, and I think the thinner papers definitely do get more translucent, and that's because of the fibers that are being compressed when you burnish a sheet of paper, and that, you know, it makes it just a little more translucent and glossy.
And then some of them are very beautifully colored. They're maroons and purples.
So sometimes that paper is dyed, and typically the dye is added to the vat. And once the paper is dry, the color is actually a pretty light shade, and then more dye is brushed onto the dry sheet to give it that really rich, rich color that you saw. So some of the dyes that they use are indigo and madder and safflower and things like that. And after you burnish it, after it's dyed, it just has the most beautiful glossy appearance and a almost leather-like quality.
So, you know, most people know that paper was invented in China with many other things, including spaghetti, and made its way west. And it made its way west along the Silk Road. So, and I wonder, can you talk a bit about the history of the migration there? Because it seems to be something that you can almost plot from the families that are still making paper.
Right. So paper was supposedly invented in China around the turn of the first century. And from there, it spread to what is now Korea and Japan, from Korea to Japan. And then it kind of stayed in East Asia for a while before it moved via the Silk Road to Samarkand, which is in Uzbekistan. And apparently, it is believed that Chinese prisoners of war traded the knowledge of papermaking for their lives, and that's how the knowledge of papermaking was transmitted.
The story there is that they were prisoners then that transmitted the
Right.
Knowledge of Papermaking,
right.
Which is interesting because, you know, there's a lot of speculation that a lot of the culture that comes out of Islam into Europe through the Crusades came by way of Spain and from Muslim prisoners of the Franks, especially, who brought their culture with them and then were engaged in households, you know, in Europe. So it's interesting that prisoners seem to be a link here in the transmission of culture.
I think Samarkand was this melting pot, you know, and it's from Samarkand where that this knowledge of papermaking changed, because the tools were adapted and the techniques were adapted from the Chinese or the Asian style to what is now called Islamic style.
Mm-hmm.
And then from Samarkand it moved to Egypt and now Saudi Arabia in the 9th century. And then also from Samarkand it moved to Spain in the early 11th century.
Mm-hmm.
And then from Spain is when it traveled and moved to the rest of Europe. And that's also when, again, the tools changed and the materials changed.
Yes.
And now we call that Western papermaking.
Yeah.
And so by the end of the 15th century, paper effectively replaced parchment as a preferred substrate to write on. But then I guess it's important to think about that from Samarkand, it went to India only in the 13th century. And that was pretty late if you think about how far paper had reached by then in Europe.
Is there then a corresponding cultural change in the Middle East at this time because of the arrival of paper, as you had in Europe, you know, with the arrival? Well, paper arrives just at the time the printing press arrives in Europe, so there's a sort of explosion of textual materials, books. Do you have that in India, Islam at the same time?
Well, I can only speak about India
because
that's my primary focus of research. And I would say that at that time, before the arrival of paper, we were using birch bark for manuscripts and palm leaf and stone and metal. And that's the material that was spread out, you know, in the north and in the south and the east and in the west. And palm leaf was used almost everywhere as well. But
mm-hmm.
when paper arrived, you know, it was a slow transition, and I would say both things existed at the same time, the use of paper and the use of all these other materials.
Yeah.
But slowly paper replaced all those other materials.
Yeah.
And then that changed again with the arrival of the British and mechanization, and which, you know, completely changed how paper was then produced. So
yeah.
the traditional paper was then replaced by this machine-made paper.
Yeah. And it's made today out of T-shirts, right? Or it's T-shirt scraps, cotton
right.
scraps. Yeah.
It's made, cotton rag scraps.
Yeah. In Europe, the technique is quite different. The Germans, when they start making paper, they use a metal screen. They don't use a reed mat, and they use something like a wine
mm-hmm.
press to get the water out, very much like
mm-hmm.
what they use with a printing press.
Right, and most of Western papermaking utilizes that. So imagine the screen affixed to a supported frame, but the screen is now metal or wire mesh.
Yeah.
And then that those two dowels and those two removable sticks then just become one frame that snaps onto that screen.
Yeah.
And that's what you would make paper out of in the West.
And in Europe, the papermakers immediately start putting their mark on the paper with watermarks. They can do it with screens.
Right.
Is that done in the East?
I haven't seen any papers with watermarks in India.
Yeah.
And there are a few papers with watermarks in Japan that I've heard of. But those aren't, to my knowledge, directly on the screen. They're on a piece of netting that's placed on the screen. But
in
Western papermaking molds, then you would, you know, sew with a piece of wire.
Yeah.
You would solder a piece together with wire and then sew that on to the screen surface.
So the families that you visit in India that still make paper, some of these families seem to have been making paper right from the beginning. It seems to be a very long-standing artisanal practice in India, isn't it?
Yeah, and the family that I visited was very well aware of their heritage, and that Mohammad Hussain Kagzi, who is the head of that household, learned it from his father, who learned it from his father, who learned it from his father, and it just goes on. That's one of the first things that they told me, was that our ancestors moved to Northwest India in the 13th century, and we've been making paper since then.
Yeah. Are there people who keep records of this, say libraries that keep track of local papermaking businesses?
Not to my knowledge.
No.
I have tried
looking
in the National Archives, but haven't had much luck.
Yeah, so it's all
but
oral
they
tradition.
Have, Right, exactly. But they do have some samples of paper that has been stamped with a particular date when it was made. And they showed me those samples, and they only date back about 100 years, but that's still pretty old.
So these are family businesses. Is it just the men in the family that make the paper, or does everyone chip in?
Well, everybody kind of chips in, but the paper makers are primarily men.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, just the way it goes in Indian culture. It's extremely sexist.
Yeah.
And so men are given these tasks that require a lot of strength, and the women are given the delicate tasks.
Yeah.
And they only teach the craft to blood relatives. So, mm-hmm. for instance, I couldn't go and, you know, ask them to teach me. They just wouldn't. And that, coupled with the fact that I'm a woman, would just never happen.
Is there anything like a guild system, or is it just apprentices kept in the family, essentially?
Right. There's no real guild system. It's just kept in the family. Yeah. And I think there is enough internal competition to prevent that kind of system.
Is there still a market for these hand-produced papers? Are people still making them, or especially with globalization, are people losing their businesses that they've had for centuries?
Well, as far as I know, there are only 7 families still making paper this way in all of India. And so that kind of gives you a picture of how well they're doing.
Yeah.
And again, to my knowledge, there's only one family that's actually making it work 6 months out of the year. I'm not sure how the others are doing. And as far as their market goes, they make paper specifically for rewriting old tattered manuscripts in temples and mosques, mm-hmm. in India, and in Kuwait and Dubai and places like that. And some paper that they make is also used by artists in India for watercolor and wash paintings.
Yeah.
So the market is pretty limited, I would say.
For specialized paper, yeah, sure.
Right.
Do you think there's possibly any opportunity to expand the market? I mean, as you research this material, do you ever wonder about the possibility of creating a greater cottage industry than what you have here? And I'm thinking a bit of what happened under Gandhi, where he promoted this kind of industry rather vigorously.
Right. I mean, I think that's a really good idea, but at the same time, I don't think that the master craftsmen who have this knowledge would be willing to teach anyone outside their family.
Yeah.
And that's where the problem lies. It's because of this, either this feeling of competition or this feeling of possessiveness that they feel for their craft tradition, that they just will not let it thrive in that way.
So what about in this country? Can you translate the processes that are used in India to other countries to develop cottage industries there, say, you know, places where especially women might benefit from having businesses that produced artisanal paper for artists and printers, fine printers, that sort of thing?
Yeah, I think it could definitely work. You know, it's just a question of the willingness of people to do it and building a market and pricing the papers right.
Yeah.
Because at the moment, you know, those beautiful papers that require so much work and so much labor are priced as low as $4 a sheet, a really big sheet. And someone making paper by hand in the U.S. will, in the Western style, will sell their paper for $22 a sheet. And it doesn't require nearly as much as effort as, you know, this traditional Islamic paper, for instance, requires.
Tremendous amount of labor. You had, I remember specifically the beginning of the process, just washing the flax in the river seemed to be very time-consuming before it was even mashed up to rid it of impurities. So is hand paper making as a craft or an art catching on in studio programs, like the program that you learned to make paper in?
Well, I would say in the U.S., it's not that popular because it's very hard to find a book arts program that also focuses on hand paper making as much as the program at Iowa does. And that was something that I was looking for specifically and had a very hard time finding when I was applying for my MFA. And there's only a handful of programs in the U.S. that actually do book arts and then maybe touch a little bit upon paper.
Yeah.
But I think that in Europe, it's definitely picking up and that's changing. In India, definitely not.
Do you make your own paper then for your artist books?
Yes. For most of my books, I do try to make the paper whenever I can.
Yeah.
Because I think it, you know, I love having that kind of control over my material.
Yeah.
And especially if I'm going to print on it, I want it to be something that either I've made or something that I know exactly what I'm going to get from it. You know, it's very easy to find paper these days that looks a lot like handmade paper but doesn't behave like handmade paper.
Yeah.
And handmade paper isn't the easiest thing to print on by hand either. But if you're looking for something very specific, which I usually am, I tend to think about making it.
In the future, I know you're going to be working here in Rosendale, New York, at the Women's Studio Workshop again this summer.
Right. I'll be teaching a class on traditional Indian papermaking.
And then as far as your future plans for your own artworks go, are you going to continue making artist books?
Yes, definitely. I think that's always going to be a part of my art practice. But again, you know, just getting better at making paper is always something that I strive for. And the more you do it with papermaking, the better you get at it. So yeah. It's just a question of doing it on a daily basis.
There's a lot of interest now in craft as art, breaking down this distinction between art and craft. And I wonder, do you ever think about that? Because, of course, papermaking is a craft, but it's a very, but making artist books is an art. So, and you seem to almost need one for the other. So is there a blending sometimes in your mind about what you're doing?
Well, there's always a blend for me. Yeah. I don't distinguish one from the other at all because they both seem to go hand in hand. And I don't think you can do one without the other because to have an artistic sense or to have an aesthetic sense and then to execute it in your craft, you know, one, they just go hand in hand so well.
Yeah.
And I think growing up in India really kind of fashioned that idea for me because there is no difference between an artisan and a craftsperson.
Yeah.
Because one is the other is the other. You know, the person that does the drawing for a woodblock is also the person who would carve the woodblock for the person who would print the woodblock on a piece of textile that somebody else has made. And so there seems to be no distinction there. And I think that that's the way it should be. You should be that connected to your work that you know it inside out.
Yeah.
At least that's the way it is for me. And one thing always leads to the other. So a paper that I make that I love, I will always be thinking about how I can apply it to my books and any techniques that I learn here and there. Like Islamic papermaking has taught me so much about natural dyes, and now it's making me think about the application of color in a completely different way. And that's feeding, again, my books.
So if someone wanted to find your artist books, you've got a website online?
Right. It's radhapandey.com.
That's RADHAPANDEY. We'll post that on our website so people can access it from library-cafe.org. And also, you have a blog also?
Yeah, so it's my full name, .blogspot.com. And that's kind of where I started. I started posting about all these things that were interesting to me. And then I guess people requested that I also have a website, so I've recently added that to my online presence.
Okay, great. So I want to thank you, Radha, for visiting with us today on the Library Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's been great.